And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
Welcome to your Chilpack Hollywood Hour, everybody. This is Phil Lernis, and across the table from me here in Los
Angeles. Hi, everybody. Look at me in Los Angeles for a change.
You were supposed to leave on the 6th.
Yes. Any day now, I'll be leaving on the 6th.
When the moving company comes and picks you up.
Picks me up and stuffs me in a box and sends me off to Detroit.
When we left off.
Yes.
Things were looking really grim for Ricky J.
Well, it depends on what grim, you know, what perspective is grim. He was dead. Yeah, but he had what a career he left behind.
Right, and we were celebrating that in something we call celebrity deaths.
Celebrity deaths.
And look, during the duration of this week's show, yeah, if Ricky J's condition should change, we will alert you.
Right. But pretty much it's final. So I don't think it's grim news.
Our rulings in celebrity deaths are final.
Are final. We kind of don't bring it up till it's final.
And yet we laugh about it, apparently.
We do.
But we laugh so that we may not cry.
Right.
And that brings us to a couple of celebrities that we didn't have time last week to remember properly.
Okay.
So we saved them for this week. The first of which, 57 years of age, uh-huh, dying of ALS,
ooh,
Steven Hillenburg,
oh,
the creator of the popular animated series SpongeBob SquarePants.
Well, I did not know this. This is news to me. So,
yeah.
ALS,
yeah,
affected, that's the Lou Gehrig disease.
Lou Gehrig disease, uh-huh, yes. Now, did you know anything about the creator of this show?
In fact, I did not. SpongeBob SquarePants came out of nowhere in my radar and enjoyed it immensely.
You did?
I did enjoy it, yes.
I never watched, but there was a SpongeBob feature film a couple years ago.
That's right, yes.
And really funny.
Yes, it is, right?
Mr. Hillenburg got his start as a marine biologist.
Oh.
Who changed careers to become an animator.
Of course.
And hence, a show based on his love of the ocean.
Of course. That all crustaceans and a squirrel that has a scuba gear in order to survive under the ocean.
Some of the other characters? His best friend, Patrick.
Yes.
His Starfish. Boss. His boss, Mr. Krabs.
The crab, yeah.
And his pet snail, Gary.
Right. Yeah. Hilarious, right? What for me was something I can relate to is the unabashed enthusiasm in lieu of a dead-end job and the hellish existence of SpongeBob from looking at it externally. His unbelievable, unending, enthusiastic spirit is something that I watch the show to attain to.
According to the first season DVD... Mm-hmm. Hillenburg pitched the show to Nickelodeon while wearing a Hawaiian shirt,
mm-hmm,
while playing Hawaiian music, and while using an underwater terrarium with models of his characters.
Okay, so this asks three questions. Did he get in before the execs to set up the music and the terrarium, or did he come in with the terrarium under his arm and just hit a tape recorder and start playing Hawaiian music?
I don't know.
I need to know these things for my next pitch.
Yeah, I think only one person's getting away with that.
Really? I was going to pitch Hawaii Five-O like that.
It's like the famous story about how Spielberg got his start, right? As a director, he just walked off the studio tour one day and then found an empty office and helped himself to it and then called in to get himself on the and just would show up. Then would go to different sets and interview the filmmakers and learn how to make movies that way.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And hearing that story, many people probably tried the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. Got
and
arrested.
That's never going to work again. They don't think, the executives don't think, oh, well, it worked so much the last time we let somebody get away with it.
Let's other 19-year-old kid do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Copycats are always, which is odd because so much of the business is just based on copycatting. Why not? But everyone's success story has to be unique to them.
Right. So my Hawaiian shirt terrarium pitch.
SpongeBob SquarePants was perhaps not coincidentally given that odd pitch meeting.
Right.
Nickelodeon's first original Saturday morning cartoon.
Really?
Yes.
No.
And
they must have, what? Was it Rugrats before that?
Look, I'm just, know, all know. I'm doing, I don't know.
You're
I'm
just
not
reading a, what you saw.
I'm just reading what I wrote down. the series is still on the air today.
Yeah.
And it has spawned two movies.
It has? I thought it was just a major feature. What's the other one?
I guess two movies. I don't know.
SpongeBob SquarePants 2.
I guess so. Let's call it that.
Yeah?
Let's call it The Awakening. All right. So Steven Hillenburg. Dead at 57. Seems like a really, really fun guy.
Yeah.
Fun guy, which will be found under the ocean.
See?
All right. Gloria Katz died.
Mm.
I think she might have been 76 years of age, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
She partnered with her husband, Willard Hike. Was one of the co-writers of George Lucas's American Graffiti.
Oh.
As well as George Lucas's Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, which I continue to believe is the underrated gem in the Indiana Jones franchise.
Temple of Doom?
I really enjoy the Temple of Doom.
Well, really?
Yeah, I think it's why... Okay, look. We wanted to talk about Gloria Katz, but to me, it's one of the movies that keeps Spielberg out of hell. even though he makes the third one to apologize for the second one.
Right.
Because I think that movie has balls, and I think how great of him to make a sequel to Raiders of the Lost Ark and say, you know what, we're giving this an entirely different tone.
That's true.
Altogether. We're going to make it this horror kind of, you know, thrill ride.
Yeah, but didn't have to have the coal cart, the roller coaster.
Yes, it did.
Yeah, so that seemed like it was just he listened to the theme park executives saying, could you make a movie where there's a ride attached to it? As opposed to the other way around.
I'm not going to get into a debate with you. I'm just going to say that you're wrong.
Okay,
and whatever. Get back to Gloria Katz.
Who
co-wrote it with her husband. Mm-hmm. So they were friends. Her husband was friends with George Lucas back at USC.
Right.
And I think Willard Hike might have worked on THX.
Oh.
But the pair, the married pair, Gloria and Willard, worked with Lucas on multiple films. They were nominated for an Oscar for American Graffiti.
Cool.
Which, of course, 1973 film about the cruising scene in California in the early 1960s. And this is what's so much fun about film, right? That one can see an authorial presence in George Lucas's direction of this movie. This is the world he knew growing up, and yet he does not write it. Right? This is still a thing that boggles the mind for some people. How can Hitchcock be considered the author of this film if he did not write it?
Right.
How can Spielberg be considered? And yet it's interesting because, as we know, Spielberg, with very rare exception, doesn't write his stuff. And yet not only, obviously, when you think back to his great box office days, are there themes running through all of it that he gravitates towards, but there's also flaws that
run through it as well
that are often a result of him. But anyway, so it's interesting to me how that film, American Graffiti, is the most outwardly, I would say, most personal of George Lucas's movies. Right.
The biggest of his fingerprints all over it.
And yet does not write it.
And does not write it. Because the script is a blueprint. The script does not have the flourishes. I'm sure, you know, the scene with the prank of chaining the back axle of the police car to a fire hydrant and then running and having that thing flip up. I'm sure that was written as one line, but to carefully go through and make that a 15-minute sequence of going through and how you crawl on your belly to get the chain around the axle of the police car, all of that built to that comic moment so well. It was great comic timing.
Well, what does a screenplay give you? If it works well, it, you know, structurally, everything else, it fundamentally can only give you what is said and what is done.
Right. And not how.
And not how those things make you feel.
Right.
You might feel a certain way reading about what is done, but you're not there the way that actors and craftsmen and filmmakers will put you there.
Right.
And it will let you experience what it's like to have felt what it was to be there when these things were said and done.
Right.
And that's the movie where probably, I don't know, I mean, maybe THX, maybe original Star Wars, but I mean, but that's the movie where I think that Lucas seems to have the most emotional connection.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. More than THX. THX seemed to me a technical wonder, and Star Wars, of course, was a team effort across the
Guess his clear affection for what he was doing, though, does come through in THX. Don't you think?
Yes. Yeah, well, affection. I think it seemed like a guy out of film school who had a lot of unique bags of tricks. That, to me, was more, and he was like, and really thrilled to use them. So he knew a lot. But
so here's what a lot of people didn't know, which was the Katz and Hiker brought in by Lucas as script doctors. We talked about William Goldman a couple weeks ago.
Right.
And, you know, his career is not only a legendary screenwriter, but also as a script doctor. They doctored Star Wars.
No, oh, I didn't know that.
And in 2017, she was allowed to kind of confess this stuff. I think Lucas had finally said, go ahead.
Yeah.
You know, and she, in an interview, said that Lucas had a lot of reservations about his script. So he said, polish it, write anything you want, and then I'll go over it and use what I need.
Ah.
And, you know, for the longest time, George didn't want anyone to know they worked on the script.
Right.
So they were kept in a cone of silence.
Oh, brother.
But she estimated that about 30% of the movie was what they contributed, you know, to the finished movie was from their script, including the humor.
Yes.
Which makes sense.
Yes, exactly.
That's why you would bring a script doctor on a lot of times.
Yeah, bring it up.
Like, okay, this works, because he had done that elaborate work of reinventing the myths. And in no small part when he was in a hospital after a major accident, right? Which is when he discovers Joseph Campbell's writings. And so he's translating The Hero of a Thousand Faces into this Luke Skywalker journey, and then says, as storytellers will, we need some jokes.
We need some
laughs.
Right. Oh, and how much on C-3PO? I stick my neck out far beyond capacity for you. The odds of going through this minefield, don't tell me the odds. Like, all of that stuff, to me, was bringing a lot of humor in there.
One of Gloria Katz's most indelible contributions to film was in changing Princess Leia's character.
Ah.
Who was, in the original script, a woman constantly needing to be rescued.
Okay.
And transformed her into a woman who was capable of taking command.
Right. And so grabbing the gun and dealing with her own rescue.
And that is a major legacy for that film. The pair also wrote screenplays for the movies Lucky Lady and Howard the Duck.
Well, you know, I think I would take a second look at Howard the Duck.
Would you?
I would now.
Okay.
I would think that I had read some of the comic books after we've seen Howard the Duck and thought, you know, missed the mark a little bit. And you were also flummoxed by the technology of the era. I think now digitally.
This would be kind of interesting. We should, the way we've done other times with like movies that, you know, every teenager should see or female directed films that everyone should see, find a list of like the biggest, like the worst turkeys of all time.
Yeah.
And
how would you fix them?
Give them a second look.
Yeah.
Give them a second look.
But also deconstruct it from the script point of view, from directing choices, from, you know, digital limitations of the era, and then go back and what would you do?
I gave a second look to Ishtar.
Oh, you did?
Not long ago.
Yeah? And what'd you think?
Worse than I think people even said at the time.
Yeah, but there's, you know, nobody goes out to make a bad movie, as we say, so there is somebody trying
spending
to do something good.
$100 million on making a bad movie.
Yeah, anyway. But that's throwing good money after bad. That wasn't the original budget.
Well, we're moving a little bit far afield,
sorry.
But isn't it incredible when you think about how many of the biggest bombs of the last 30 years, 30 or 40 years, were Warren Beatty was involved in? It's true. I mean, at least three off the top of my head. Ishtar, that recent one, Rules Don't Apply, where he plays, you know, I mean, that one is such a bomb that it leads to a lawsuit about him owing the investors money.
Oh, right. The Howard's.
And what about Town and Country?
Oh,
do you remember that?
Yes.
With Gary Shandling?
It's in the, it's like, not the Second Wives Club, but yeah, it was
something like that.
It was a thing like that, yes.
So, anyway.
And what about Bulworth? Was that...
No, that was a modestly sized
hit
film, and it hit, and it got good reviews.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a pretty charming, funny
movie. It's charming.
Movie.
He charmed his way through it, but structurally and all that, there needed to be more to it, but...
So anyway, one final note on Gloria Katz. Yes, dead at 76. She dies on the occasion of her 49th wedding anniversary.
Aww.
So, all right. We can close up the Chill Pack Morgue until at least next week.
Very good.
And thank goodness. And I want to talk to you about a couple of movies.
Okay, let's hear them.
So we spoke about Orson Welles' The Other Side of the Wind.
Yes.
Have you had a chance to catch... also on Netflix, the documentary about the making of that film.
Yeah, in fact, I started watching that first, shut that off.
Yeah, you had to.
Yeah, and then
because the style of... So the documentary is from Aaron Neville, who won an Oscar for, what is it, 20 Feet from Stardom?
Yeah.
And who did
about
this...
About backup singers.
This summer's terrific Mr. Rogers documentary.
That's right.
Won't You Be My Neighbor?
Yeah.
And he does a movie called They'll Love Me When I'm Dead.
You'll Love Me When I'm Dead, which may or may not be a quote that Orson Welles said, right?
Right. And it uses a lot of the styles, cinematographically and editorially, that Welles uses, that his cinematographer and production partner Gary Graver used while making The Other Side of the Wind.
Yeah.
So to... Yeah, to see that document, I've heard people who have like watched the documentary first, and I do think it's a little bit of a mistake.
Mistake, yeah, I stopped.
Not because it spoils anything, but I actually think the documentary is just much more enjoyable if you've seen the movie.
Yeah, and he's taking clips from The Other Side of the Wind a lot. There's a lot, it's sprinkled.
But a lot of clips that aren't in the movie.
Yeah.
I mean,
also.
So because here's a movie, right, as we know, it starts shooting in 1971, and in 85, when Welles dies, it's not done.
Right.
And one of the most astounding pieces to me is about how Welles' good friend and acolyte, I guess we can say, protege, Peter Bogdanovich, in 1971, is a film journalist who has made a movie. He made that movie that we talked about before, Boris Karloff's final movie.
Oh, yeah.
Targets?
Targets.
Which is a good movie, an interesting movie. I mean, especially for Corman.
Yeah.
And Karloff's great in it, by the way. But and that same drive-in from Targets is in The Other Side of the Wind.
Oh, is that the same one?
Yeah. So
that's hilarious.
Anyway, but basically, Bogdanovich is playing who he was in 1971.
Yeah.
In the footage they show from 1971 of The Other Side of the Wind. a journalist who spends a lot of his time doing a Jerry Lewis impression.
Yeah, right.
And in the character of a acolyte filmmaker who's very successful, whose success has eclipsed that of the master, played by John Huston, Rich Little is cast to play the wisecracking, constantly impersonating Hollywood stars filmmaker.
Right.
Okay, so by the time 75 rolls around, they get Bogdanovich to replace all of Rich Little's stuff because Rich Little couldn't act.
So they said, but you saw the footage in the documentary.
Well, but okay so whatever. Hold on. So there's so many places to go with this.
Yeah, right.
And see, this is the thing that's so challenging about this documentary. But I want to
go back to that Rich Little thing.
But I want to run the line with Bogdanovich.
Okay.
Because what's fascinating is that by 75, when Bogdanovich is brought in to redo all of Rich Little's stuff,
he's now
Bogdanovich
famous.
Is now literally playing himself again.
Again.
Because he's every bit the most successful director in the world who constantly keeps crews laughing by doing famous Hollywood impersonations.
From The Last Picture Show, which was a major hit. And
But Paper Moon.
Paper Moon. He was like...
What's Up, Doc? And so anyway, so he was huge celebrity director, box office powerhouse. And he loved doing impersonations of everyone from John Ford and Orson Welles to Alfred Hitchcock, on and on and on and on. So he's now, again, somehow playing himself, which is exactly what he was doing in 71.
Yeah, right.
They cut that part, the 1971 journalist, out, replace him with another journalist character. Okay. So that's some fascinating stuff. Meanwhile, some of Rich Little's stuff still ends up in the movie. He's just now another filmmaker.
Right.
But he doesn't have that relationship with John Huston's character.
Yeah, where they
cut
that.
Following us? Hopefully not, because it's incredible. But so now we go back to Rich Little. Now, Rich Little is interviewed in this.
Yes.
And could not be more bitter.
I know.
Oh my God, he's an angry, angry guy. Now, everyone I have talked to about this who knows him said, yeah, why the fuck he was cast... He couldn't act his way out of a paper bag. And indeed, he doesn't seem like somebody who really is that given to listening and reacting. He seems like, I'm going to create and present.
Right, which is a stand-up
thing. He'd not acted. Right. But there are, by the way, some... he famously did an interview on Carson where he talked about that.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. Our friend who writes in a lot, Maurice Terenzio, told me a great Rich Little story that I'll share in a future installment.
Awesome.
Or maybe I'll get Maurice himself
to tell
the story because it's great. Okay. It's about John Huston, Orson Welles, Rich Little being in a diner together while making the movie.
Oh my God!
And you know
sounds like a joke.
And
Rich Little did Orson Welles walk into a diner.
And some young woman comes up, and the only one she recognizes is Rich Little. Yeah, anyway, but that's where the story begins. But, okay, so let's talk about this. First of all, the story where Orson Welles brings Rich Little to the set and introduces him to John Huston for the first time is phenomenal. Orson Welles says, John, I'd like you to meet Rich Little, one of the world's great impressionists. And John Huston says, oh, well, I love art. We'll get along fine. Yes. And then Orson has to say, no. He does voices of famous people. And John Huston says, well, why would he want to do that? Why don't they just get the real people? And then he walks away. Like, that is such a great story.
Yeah.
Because you know Welles is setting Rich Little up to get cut down by John Huston. And it's so great that Huston does it because that's the relationship in the movie.
That's the whole thing. He's setting up in real life what he needs for the actor and the character to be doing.
Yeah
it's pretty brilliant. I don't know. And, when he said that story, I'm going... Did he do that on purpose, or was that a lucky accident? Because so much of what it seemed in the documentary, what that Orson Welles was going for, was to create lucky accidents.
Absolutely. He says that a movie director is a presider over accidents.
Yes.
And how can you make the accidents into gold?
Right. And so this...
Our theme song, not this week, but our Motown-influenced theme song
is a lucky accident.
Is very much, as I was telling you, a product of a lucky accident, which we'll talk about again in the future at some point.
But so, okay, so now this then goes to, did Orson Welles cast... a stand-up comic with no acting training, specifically to get lucky accidents.
Yeah.
Or because he knew he wanted impersonations, but did he need an actor? Because it seemed like also some of the other actors in the movie had little acting experience, but
right,
particularly
a lot of non-actors.
Right. So it felt like that Orson Welles was going into a project where he was removing that artifice in order to find real, air quote, accidents to edit together a brand new way of storytelling, not using professional actors other than your lead actor, John Huston, and everyone else can just sort of be winging it and flying around. So to me, casting Rich Little was not a massive mistake, but trying to make accidents happen by having a guy who's not a professional actor go in. So to throw Rich Little under the bus on this one, I maybe because I know I met Rich Little once, I liked him. I remember as a kid I liking him, and to go, well, he's a crappy actor. He was never an actor. He was always an impressionist.
That's a good point. That's a good point. And you're not cutting out other people for the same reason.
Exactly.
Yeah. But you know, it's so tempting to see the making of the movie. So here's we know that he's making a movie about a over the hill filmmaker who's trying to regain past glory,
mm-hmm.
and who is not able to finish his movie before he dies and only gets to screen the rough cut of it
at a party. Yep.
And in real life, the movie that Welles is making about that, he does not finish before he dies and only is ever allowed one screening of a rough cut at a party.
Right.
So it's tempting to see
the
everything paralleled throughout it, right?
Yep.
To see John Huston, maybe that temptation is right, because I'm just suddenly realizing that maybe the problem was for Welles that, because he goes to Bogdanovich so fast, he could have cast actors. And Bogdanovich did have acting background. There's no question about that. And there is something fun about having directors play directors. But John Huston was from an acting family.
Yes.
And John Huston had acted successfully. But why Bogdanovich? Why not, if you're having trouble? If the problem is Rich Little can't act, Why not get an actor?
Get Ryan O'Neill at that time.
But no, he gets...
another director.
He gets another director. He gets Bogdanovich, which makes me wonder, and we're just armchair psychologists on this, but again, the temptation is to see where does the real world reflect in that movie and how does that movie reflect the real world of Welles. It seems to me that the problem was Rich Little just wasn't coming across like Peter Bogdanovich, which is what he wanted. And he stayed away from that.
Mm.
Why does he not play the filmmaker? Because he doesn't want people to think this is about him. It's about him in the sense that it's about his love of cinema. It's about his disgust of what cinema was becoming.
Mm-hmm.
It's his way of taking certain European cinema traditions of the 60s to task.
Right.
It's his way of warning us about what movies were going to become.
Right.
It's his commentary on the cult of movie maker personality. It's so many things, but he didn't want it to be thought of as biographical.
Right.
And remember his big regret, Welles' big regret about the Citizen Kane was that he too closely made people think it's a bio of Hearst.
Yes.
That was the regret he had in some cases, especially where Marion Davies was concerned.
Marion Davies, so then thrown under the bus as the opera star.
So, you know, it's understandable then that he thinks, okay, John Huston will play this figure and will make it a Hemingway type figure. John right. Huston is a Hemingway figure. Well, quite frankly, Wells was a Hemingway figure. He was going to the bullfights all the
totally.
Time. He was living in
seeing
Spain.
All the whole thing.
But so I think he wanted to keep this idea of, okay, I'm going to depict this relationship
right.
That I have with Bogdanovich. And I'm going to depict it. But I want it to be depicted through filters, i.e. John Huston and at first Rich Little.
Right.
And he doesn't get the relationship that he wants on screen.
Right.
And so he goes, well, why don't I just put the real person in?
To get that relationship.
Doesn't that make sense?
Yes. I guess. Well, because that relationship, again, that's then, it's not even an acting thing. It's an improv thing. Building relationships on stage. Building, how do you immediately have a seeming relationship with somebody else in the spur of a moment that seems like you knew each other
yeah.
all your life. That's not necessarily acting.
And by the way, here is a movie where, as we know, through a lot of Bogdanovich's 1975 stuff, he's not acting with John Huston. He's acting with Orson Welles because John Huston is directing Man Who Would Be King.
Oh, that's right.
So it's Welles' voice
off camera.
He's acting, and those scenes are chilling.
Yeah.
When the character that John Huston is playing is voiced by Welles asking Bogdanovich for money.
Yeah, that's chilling.
It's chilling. And then, of course, as we know from the documentary, Welles ends up moving in with Bogdanovich to shoot some parts of the movie in the house Bogdanovich shares with Sybil Shepherd. And there's a character in the movie that's all about making fun of Sybil Shepherd
and
Bogdanovich's relationship with her.
Oh my God.
So we could just go on and on about this, but I wanna wrap out the Bogdanovich thing. Just one last thing, and this just really stunned me. The movie starts shooting in 71. Bogdanovich is playing himself as a wannabe filmmaker, aspiring filmmaker, one feature under his belt. By 75, he's now playing himself as what he was, the most successful filmmaker in Hollywood. By the time Welles dies, and even before that, I think it's 82, the trial where he tries in French courts to get the rights, as the author of the piece tries to get the rights back from the Iranian government and fails. By that time, Bogdanovich's directing career is pretty much over.
I know, right?
It's begun, crested, and fallen off, all in the range of shooting The Other Side of the Wind.
Isn't that amazing?
I mean, Bogdanovich would then have some comebacks and go on.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's stunning.
That's pretty cool. That's really amazing. So I recommend everybody watch The Other Side of the Wind first, then go back and watch the documentary.
Yeah, and don't tell us, you know, I tried to watch it and I really didn't enjoy it.
Don't say that?
Yeah, don't say that. Okay. Nobody cares.
What?
That's not the point.
All right.
That's not the point. Treat yourself. Enrich yourself. Live a life. Experience.
Oh my God, that's terrible. That sounds like you're saying get a life.
No, live a life.
Live a
you
life.
Know?
Yeah, okay.
It's not just about being diverted. It's
right.
not just about being entertained. It's about having your life enriched with thoughts and conversation. That's why we're still doing this podcast after 11 years.
Is that why? Yeah. I needed some focus again.
Okay. By the way, speaking of Welles, one of the things that I don't know whether I used it as a palate cleanser after that double
Delicious.
Feature of The Other Side of the Wind and Love Me When I'm Dead. Or just because it had been a long time since I'd seen it, but I watched his 62 adaptation of The Trial.
Oh, yes,
again.
With Perkins.
Anthony Perkins.
Yeah.
And you know what I was stunned by this time?
Lighting.
No, I mean, I was stunned by the lighting, the cinematography, much before, but it's a dark comedy. He directed that as a dark comedy.
Well, because, yeah, The Trial, isn't that based on a play? Wasn't that...
Well, it's a book. It's Kafka's book. I don't think it was based on a play.
Right. Mm.
And the thing that Welles did that was amazing was he takes the chapters out of order because then you find out after the fact that the publisher had on their own rearranged the chapters. So Welles wasn't wrong to do it.
All right.
But there's also some interesting sci-fi elements. Like they're on computers in it that are not in the book. And, you know, he changes some things in an interesting way. But really, it's... It's a it's a dark comedy. I mean, it's played for those kind of laughs that stick in the back of your throat.
Yeah.
Because it's funny and it's so weird, but then you're going like, but this is so weird, I'm uncomfortable.
And the bureaucracy and all of all of that. When the Berlin Wall fell down, 91, and the playwright took over the country of, Hungary? Yes, who was the playwright who then became the president or prime minister of one of the Eastern Bloc countries? His name escapes me. Anyway, in university, we did one of his plays, which was like the trial. It was all about bureaucracy and paperwork, and it was one of his plays commenting on the Soviet...
Pinter, I don't know.
No, wasn't Pinter. Oh my gosh, now I need Google.
So many playwrights are hungry, though. For
Hungarian.
Oh,
from Hungary.
Oh, I see.
Not Hungary. Right.
Hey, you know, a filmmaker, unlike Wells, who has achieved box office success and accolades from his peers, including, I think, a Best Director Oscar, if I'm not mistaken, is Steve McQueen.
Oh, yes.
A
Steve McQueen.
Look, just to be a Steve McQueen is an honor. Just to be nominated as a Steve McQueen is an honor. The director that I love pointing out, using when I point out how much it annoys me when a filmmaker like Spike Lee is referred to as an African-American filmmaker, right? Because Steve McQueen, a black man, is not referred to as an African-Scottish filmmaker.
African-Scottish.
Yeah, right? And here, in all the interviews, he's always referred to as a filmmaker.
Right.
Which is, it just drives me nuts. Anyway, but here's, so he did 12 Years a Slave. Mm-hmm. I think won the Oscar for Best Director for that.
Very well done.
And before that, Shame with Michael Fassbender and Carey Mulligan. And before that, Hunger. And I don't know if his filmography goes back beyond that. But his new film is out. It's an adaptation of a 1980s ITV television series called Widows.
Oh, yes.
So you've seen that this is out.
Yes. Now, this is the thing where the wives take over the bank job of their husbands who die trying to do that bank job.
Trying to do a job gone wrong. Yeah, right. A heist film. They are not coerced into doing it, but they're pressured by various influences, and they think the best way out is to go ahead with this job.
Right.
It was, like I said, based on a 1983 ITV series, a British-American co-production. And the film features an ensemble cast consisting of Viola Davis, Michelle Rodriguez, Elizabeth Debicki, who's fantastic, Cynthia Erivo, Colin Farrell, Brian Tyree Henry, Daniel Kaluuya, Jackie Weaver, Carrie Coon, Robert Duvall, and Liam Neeson. Okay.
Wow. Big cast.
So it's a heist movie. It's a drama. There's some mystery in it. It's a political commentary because it's about the inner workings of politics, the machine, the alderman system in Chicago. It's a rich, rich brew. Mm. And as with all his other movies, hailed by critics.
Mm. I'm feeling a wind.
It's beloved.
I'm feeling the air temperature drop in the room.
I think he's a hack. I think Steve McQueen is a hack.
Here we go.
This movie is utterly ludicrous, and it's ludicrous in the way that only, like, every heist movie is ludicrous.
There's
right?
always,
But they're always ridiculous, but they're not ludicrous. What is ludicrous to me is using, for example, the real-world tension of an unarmed African-American boy in a routine traffic stop getting shot and killed by a white police officer, and using that to ratchet up the tension in a movie that's about a fictional heist.
What?
That, to me, is ludicrous.
That's pretty harsh.
But it was that moment that what really sits wrong with me about Steve McQueen's movies, all of them that I've mentioned. Again, I don't know, but Hunger, Shame, 12 Years a Slave, and now this. He's an exploitation filmmaker. That's what he is. And he gravitates towards themes that are weighty enough in terms of their social relevancy, not only to get away with it, but to allow audiences and critics to get away with how much they love exploitation.
Oh, this is fascinating.
I'm not enjoying or embracing exploitation.
No.
I'm enjoying and embracing a message picture about how bad slavery is.
Right.
Did we need that message?
No. We knew.
Do you remember the fun show, the Big and Tall show?
Yes. You produced
downtown. And when our friend Sully McCullough appeared on one of the nights of the Big and Tall. And I don't know if you remember this, but he was commenting on how, you know, it's Christmas, which at the multiplex must mean that we get to see slaves or pedophile priests or Nazis.
Right.
Right, because those are always the movies that come out at Christmas. This year we get the one about Dick Cheney and the fix always having been in our political system.
Right.
Happy Christmas, everybody. But cinematic coal for your stocking. But he had that great line, Sully. I don't know if you remember this.
No.
But he said, you know what I don't know what my favorite genre is, but I know what my least favorite genre is. Slave movies.
Oh, my God. It's true.
Sully, an African-American comedian. He doesn't need these movies
right.
to have the ills of slavery proven to him.
Right. Over and over again.
Yeah. So anyway, but why do we make these movies? And then I'm going to make a serious movie about a character who has a sex addiction.
Right.
Okay. People have that. That is a movie to make. And Steve McQueen and the movie Shame got embraced by critics and awards groups. And it was an exploitation movie.
Because it's just going through.
It exploited its subject matter.
Right.
You know, Woman Under the Influence, a John Cassavetes movie you know I love. Here's a movie where you don't get to see any substances that the wife might be abusing.
Just see her.
You know why? Because the family wouldn't get to.
Right.
It would be hidden from them. Yep. What they get to see is the erratic behavior.
Interesting.
We don't get the enjoyment of the exploitation of the purient parts of that lifestyle.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So much of those movies could tell the same story without the visualization and the careful recreation of
and look, the I call them a hack, and that's very judgmental. And
you're not backing down.
He makes the movies he wants to make, right? Yeah. And I'm just saying, as a audience member, that's how I feel.
Right,
right. I feel exploited. I feel taken advantage of. And I know some people enjoy exploitation, and there is enjoyment to exploitation. But what I enjoy more is a movie that just out and out says, yeah.
Yeah.
This is an exploitation movie.
And you are enjoying it.
Don't hide under making it acceptable, making it palatable
by
embracing themes that support an audience's lazy, pre-existing moral assumptions.
Yeah, look at that. Suck it, Steve McQueen. You heard it here, man.
And, you know, for example,
oh, yeah.
What about...
what did you see?
No, Quentin Tarantino.
Oh, yeah.
He's made a movie about themes.
Right.
And slaves and this.
But Django.
But, you know, he subverts your easy moral assumptions.
It's true, right?
And subverts your usual enjoyment and makes you question your usual enjoyment. He is, while seemingly overtly an exploitation filmmaker.
Right. And enjoying the concept of exploitation.
He's subversive.
He is subversive. He undermines it.
He may not undermine the exploitation,
right.
But he does subvert audiences' pre-existing lazy moral assumptions.
Right.
And Steve McQueen's work embraces them and uses those to get away with exploitation content. And I find it... to be
repugnant,
ludicrous.
Ludicrous. Oh, yeah, that's the word.
Ludicrous.
So,
and again, I have a podcast where I talk about movies, so that's why I talk about it. In reality, of course, I think it's important for when filmmakers disagree to tell a better story then.
Right.
And I've done that with The Lady Killers,
right?
A movie that will not get embraced the way that his approach does.
Right. So there
to
you
which
go.
I can only attribute it to blatant reverse racism. No, oh that's God. A joke.
That's oh terrible.
God. And out of context, that's going to like show up.
Oh, that's print, good.
And then that's it. And it's
this
like,
is all over.
I'm so, that's so it. Joking. anyway, and I must say also about this movie, Widows, Viola Davis.
Yeah.
Really problematic.
Is she?
She's such a great actress, and they get her because she's a great actress, but it's really a movie star role, not right. a great actress role, because there's nothing worthy
for her to do
of her greatness
right.
to explore.
She is.
There really isn't. She's doing it. She's selling. She's doing their heavy lifting for them.
Right.
But it's not worthy of her. And that weight that she brings to it kind of drags it down for me a bit in an interesting way.
Oh, okay. All right.
Quite a different beast altogether.
Yes.
From another recently honored filmmaker, the director of the Oscar winner for Best Picture a couple years ago, Moonlight.
Yes.
The director of Moonlight is back, Barry Jenkins, with a film based on the great James Baldwin novel, If Beale Street Could Talk.
Don't know a thing about this.
It is a romantic drama
mm-hmm.
written also by Barry Jenkins.
Mm-hmm.
It stars Kiki Layne, Stephen James, Coleman Domingo, Tayana Paris, Michael Beach, Dave Franco, unfortunately, in a very unfortunate supporting turn. Diego Luna. How can we cut this down? I have an idea. Regina King.
Okay.
Who is winning a lot of critics' awards for Best Supporting Actress.
Great.
And is so good in it. So it is, it's a film about a young African-American couple
they move to Beale Street.
They fall in love, and they're going to have a baby.
On Beale Street.
And the young man is wrongfully, we believe, accused of a crime.
Okay.
Though we don't ever get to know whether he's wrongfully accused, and he does end up having to serve the sentence.
Uh-huh.
And it's what binds them together and what threatens to pull them apart. It's a very simple story. It is...
Right?
Like Moonlight, it is incredibly poetic.
Uh-huh. On Beale Street. Where does Beale Street come in? That's what
if Beale Street could talk. So the title of that.
Yeah.
Because Beale Street's in New Orleans.
Ah, right, yeah.
And it's an old jazz term.
Mm-hmm.
And James Baldwin writes about it in his book and the opening stanzas of the movie explain it, but the explanation doesn't go as far as I know jazz music goes. There's an answer that involves Louis Armstrong. The upshot is, after a couple weeks, I don't remember. But if Beale Street could talk, it would explain to us what that title means.
Fantastic.
But this is a lovely film that people are
loving,
again embracing, some critics falling all over themselves for uh-huh. it is the acting's wonderful. As I said, Regina King as the girl's mom is amazing. It's an important film, again, because so much of the prison system, the judicial system, and how it treats African Americans is still so prescient,
right.
and so relevant decades after Baldwin wrote this book. Second movies are a bitch.
Right. Sophomore.
And this is Barry Jenkins' second movie. And when you were really successful and rewarded with your first film, your second film is going to have fewer limitations.
Right. Yes, you're off the leash.
And limitations can be helpful.
Very helpful.
So,
how you work against your limitations is your artistry.
So this movie, do you remember Moonlight very well?
Not really well.
Okay, so that was an interesting film structurally. It was three distinct acts
yeah.
with three different actors playing the character.
Yep.
Growing up and embracing his own sexual identity.
Mm-hmm.
And as with an anthology film, there's a certain level of it being a workout as a viewer, I have always found, because
right.
you come to an end, and then okay, I've got to start again.
Restart, yeah.
Get back into it, engage with it. What is it now? Where are we?
What's the survey?
You know, as they say in screenwriting classes, those first 10 pages are about laying out all the questions: the who, what, where, when, why, how.
Yeah.
Because an audience is asking those things, and so as an audience member, going through those questions three times: how does this link? What is it? You know, can be tiring, and yeah. yet in Moonlight, rewarding.
It pays off.
It pays off, and each chapter deepens into the next chapter, et cetera.
Okay.
This film, while linear,
good,
I found to be every bit as hard work.
What?
Because we kept going out of the linear narrative and into the subjective experiential of memories. The dreamlike poetry of the two people falling in love.
Okay.
Stretched out over and intercut with the narrative that the film is telling. And it kind of feels to me like something on page. I was going to say on the script, but then, oh, right, it's a book.
It's a book.
On the page? Yeah, that works.
That works great.
That works great. But in film, a little bit goes a long way, and you're threatening the cessation of momentum again and again. And that's what you have.
So it's a non-starter.
It's an often starter and an often stopper. And then start again.
Start again. So no momentum allowed to be built because you go in a dreamlike state over and over again.
So I would have it under the... Look, Barry Jenkins is certainly has the makings of a great filmmaker.
Right.
And you can't say that after one great film.
Right.
You can't, right? I mean, we've talked about over the last 2 weeks a couple of filmmakers. We talked about Bertolucci. Who was a great filmmaker, but greatness started at the top and then... The more he gravitated towards Hollywood, the less great he became, and he kind of just petered out.
Yep.
Petered out. Whereas most great filmmakers, no matter what their peak is, the films that come away from their peak are at least as interesting in retrospect as the films that led up to the peak.
Right.
Not at the time. In context, they may be discarded because, oh boy, they're not what they used to be.
Exactly. But then upon rewatching,
you go, no, these are exciting.
They're kind of fascinating ideas.
But it's always the time. But it's always more exciting to discover someone who's on their way. But I think Barry Jenkins, obviously, with his sensitivities and his artistry and the performances that he gets working both with veteran performers and with newcomers... there is so much mastery there already that you think this guy is equipped to be in it for the long haul if he gets the financing to make these kind of personal pictures, which we know isn't easy.
Right.
He may end up being a TV director on HBO series
because that's where
people will support it. But if allowed to work on this big canvas, he's certainly worthy of it and I would think has that career ahead of him. That said, second movies are tough, and this movie is a what I would term a noble failure, but a noble failure in that his failings are more interesting than most filmmakers' successes.
Ah, there you go. So that's If Beale Street Could Talk, where we don't know how Beale Street at all functions in the movie, but other than it's in New Orleans somewhere.
Look at us. We actually... got through almost an entire second episode pre-recorded.
Holy crap.
Pre-recorded, I just said.
What? You screwed it up again. Oh, well.
So that means this weekend we'll get to pre-record a couple shows for the following weeks.
That means Christmas is off.
Thank God. Thank God, because I really, as you know, need help setting up my negativity scene.
Yes, instead of your nativity, you're doing a negativity scene out in the front lawn.
What are you? So are you going to be in Motown, the Motor City, for Christmas?
Being Detroit Christmas, my very first.
What are the plans?
Well, there's going to be a tree, maybe, and there's snow. There's already snow in Detroit. Other plans include our annual gift-giving tradition of by going to a gas station and buying a gift individually while the other pumps gas into the car. That is an annual. Often, every Christmas, we have driven somewhere to see family and often could not get away till Christmas Eve. So we'd find ourselves somewhere in the middle of America, and our Christmas gift tradition is a gas station gift.
You better hope that the gas station isn't Buc-ee's, or that could be an all-day shopping thing. Remember Buc-ee's Texas?
Yeah, that was huge.
Oh, but they're huge.
Yeah.
They're huge. Like, that's a destination that people on the road to Texas.
And there's one in Gadgets that's massive. Yeah. That's got a movie theater and a showers in it.
Well, yeah, the bathrooms alone are like the Grand Salon of Versailles.
I know. So we stop at these gas stations on our travels, and so now we're so used to that, that's our Christmas tradition.
So you are going to be in Detroit for the long haul.
Yes, for the foreseeable future, as they say.
At least as long as there's an automotive business and an economy.
Well,
and
yes, with the GM closing plants and everything, we may be back here sooner than later.
Please watch the horror movie It Follows. Please watch that.
I watched it already.
Oh, okay, would you?
Yeah, but I got to watch it again because I didn't realize that was Detroit.
Yeah, and that's where you're going to be.
Yeah, I know. Right. So now I'm scared.
So let me ask you this. Are you in your new homestead?
Yeah.
Any plans of getting a dog?
Yeah.
Do you?
Yeah.
Have you talked about that?
Yeah, we have. And a cat, maybe.
Really?
Yes, a cat first and maybe a dog.
Oh, my goodness.
Your joy with Fuzz Aldrin has inspired us now to make us realize that a cat is lovely to have around. And then and some dogs, too. And fill up the house with animals, because my pet portraits, portraits continue to sell around the world.
Almost a year ago, you were here, and on the evening, like before Fuzz went to hospital, almost died.
Yes.
And you saw Fuzz tonight, and she could not be stronger.
Could not be stronger and happy to see me.
Yes.
So, delight.
Well, that's very exciting.
Yes. So, that's we'll keep you informed on all the pets. And, you know, we got a house that's under-insulated, so I've been insulating and fixing things that haven't been fixed since 1991. And, the house sat on the market for a year, so it's been
under-insulated. Is that because they grow people sturdier out there who are just tougher?
It's, you know what? It might be.
Because you don't have the Winnipeg wiring anymore.
It's true. That's been dismantled for 20 years of warm sunshine and Australian summers that were Decembers.
I think, even though you were still in cold climes, I think craft services first starts to diminish that, right? When you're on set, it might be cold, but when you have people bringing you things.
Exactly. Oh, my God. And then there was in Vancouver, somebody makes a pair of long underwear that connects to a 9-volt battery that heats up so that on a day where you have to pretend you're walking around in the woods in Stanley Park or in the woods, and it may be, you know, -1 or whatever, they will plug you into a long thermal underwear that actually are electric and heat up like a warm blanket.
Yeah, see, that right there is going to make you
totally not handle Detroit at all.
I think we understand why it's under-insulated. Because there's no plug-in underwear built into the house.
It is so sad. Yeah. So
How can I get that underwear in between the wall?
That's right. That's called thermal radiant heat. That's what I'm going to put in there, radiant heat. So So Christmas plans are unpacking everything from Los Angeles that arrives there maybe 5 days before Christmas. It'll be like Christmas all over again.
Okay.
Unpacking our stuff and setting it up.
Well, we'll certainly talk again before then.
Yes.
And find out more about what's going on. But what about also any news in terms of performing or?
Yeah, well, there's many opportunities going on. And of course, I'll be at X-Fest in the new year.
Isn't that like spring, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, that's a spring gig.
Is it? Like May or something?
Yeah.
Because Tom and Bruce are going to be there.
Yeah, it's a big all three Lone Gunman experience.
And when I drive you to downtown after we're done.
Yes. You got a plan?
We got to talk about Spectres 2.
Oh, okay.
Because I got
you got a plan for the three of us?
Well, I got the official go ahead in terms of you guys should put down on paper, at least, what ideas you have.
Okay.
So, but yes, an idea that involves them. Wow. And why wouldn't we take advantage of the three of you being together and shooting
a
there?
Something.
Because
yeah.
It's a pretty funny idea.
Okay, yeah. Awesome.
All right. Well, that's exciting. And you're going to do improv, I would imagine, right?
Improv, yeah. There's a lovely, there's a couple of improv theaters there. I'm in contact with the artistic directors. And I will, as soon as my feet are landed, as they say, we'll be hitting the boards.
So two other updates. One, you had mentioned that you might be getting a theatrical rep in Toronto.
Yes, it's true. I am now repped by Paul Hemrand of Edna Talent Management.
They're good.
Right across from the AGO, the Ontario Art Gallery. When you're at the AGO, just look across the street, and there's my acting rep. So for all your acting needs, contact Paul.
I think I've seen that art gallery in a Sarah Pauley movie.
It could very well be. AGO is quite famous.
I made a joke when you handed me a gift. Is it your graphic novel?
And I said, it's very close.
And what does that mean?
That means I am at inking stage right now, coloring. I'm suggesting if I get my studio set up in record time, this thing will be up and happening.
What would record time be? Would that be 33 and a third?
No, 78. What are you? I'm a collector classic. What are you, nuts?
Oh, my God.
78 time. So, yes, no, I have a lovely studio over the garage now. And so
I joked with Lily about this, but this is actually something I really seriously want to try at some point. Because remember, I told you I met a listener of ours, Jimmy Lawler, who used to listen to our show
at
double speed.
Double speed.
Because you could do it in a 30-minute commute.
Yeah, right.
And then when we were first face-to-face talking, it was really disturbing for him
to hear my voice. Slow down.
So what I want to do is I want us to record a show like at quadruple speed, see if we can do it, record for 15 minutes, and then slow it down by a factor of four to be a one-hour show. Let's see how that sounds.
Wow. So we all sound like we're taking cough medicine?
Yeah. I mean, we're in year 11. I mean...
Yeah, right? You're in it for the long haul?
Anything goes. If anybody's still listening, there's nothing that we can do short of me claiming that I am a victim of reverse racism that could get them to stop listening.
Gosh.
There is nothing. Okay. All right. That's awesome. The end of another bizarre installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Merry happy birthday to you.
Hey, I guess we didn't wish people a happy Hanukkah while it was Hanukkah,
right.
But we hope that they had a happy Hanukkah and we hope they're enjoying Advent.
Yes.
All right.
Yes, of course.
People can find every installment of their Chill Pack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com, CHILLPAK, Hollywood.com. Download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
Write a review, even.
What could be more fun?
Write us an email at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We're at Dean and Phil. So
spell out the word and.
Yes, please do that.
Hashtag we give good hashtag.
Are we still on Facebook?
We are.
Oh.
It's you, me, and 50 million Russian bots. 50 million Russian bots can't be wrong.
Totally not. They're called Rush bots.
Facebook.com/ Chill Pack Hollywood. We ought to talk about this. What is going to replace Facebook? Because something will.
Yeah, MySpace. Instagram.
And we'll still be doing this show.
Yeah.
But I don't feel like Instagram replaces it. It's a different function.
Let's go back to MySpace. We're still on there.
But maybe that is it. Maybe it's different platforms that do one thing versus...
trying to be all things for everybody. Things.
Maybe. Who knows? All right.
Let's do it.
Until next time, I'm Phil Larinus.
I'm Dean Haglund.
Guests of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn. In a historic building in downtown Los Angeles. Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.